Hawaii County is running out of options in disposing of its waste material, and with the impending closure of the South Hilo Sanitary Landfill, will begin the expensive process of trucking waste from Hilo to the other side of Hawaii Island. And as Bill Kukarski, the director of the Hawaii County Department of Environmental Management, reminds us, the county's responsibility for the landfill won't end with its closure. He's on the line from Hawaii Island. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Chris. How are you today?
All right. This obviously our waste is kind of running away with us, isn't it?
Well, we have pretty good control of the solid waste issues on the Big Island. I'm happy to say it is a problem that we have been working on with both our recycling and our other types of diversion activities.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually in better shape than most people think, and for that I'm very grateful.
Now, that's good to hear. When you describe diversion activities, what do those entail?
Well, for example, we have green waste that we take and that we used to deposit into the landfill, and we are now diverting that into mulch and into compost, and that takes about 32,000 tons of waste a year out of our system, and doesn't go into the landfill anymore. And our other recycling activities for the mixed waste, which is the cardboard and plastics that we can recycle, are also diverted.
Mm-hmm.
And we have other programs like our reuse centers, where people have furniture or clothing or things that would normally just be thrown away that we can now reuse and repurpose. So we're doing reasonably well.
The separating of green waste, for example, is that pretty labor intensive?
Actually, it's not that labor intensive to separate, because it comes in as a separate load. So the commercial operators that do tree trimming and that type of operation, they can no longer deposit or dispose of that material into the landfill. They are required to bring it into our processing facilities. We have one both in Hilo and in Pu'uanahulu.
Mm-hmm.
And they pay only 25% of the disposal fee to do that. So there's an incentive for them to bring that in and get that waste materials reused and make it not a waste but a new product. So,
well, part of the whole thing of taking care of waste material is kind of a change in the culture at the individual level, where people need to understand the separating out their trash and things like that. Are people getting better educated about that?
Yes, we have. The issue that we have here, of course, is that we are so far away from everybody else. I mean,
yeah.
We're 3,000 miles from anywhere except Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenges that we face are much different than might be faced in a community on the mainland. When we talk about sustainability, that's not a concept. That's a requirement for us as a an island county and an island state mm-hmm. to face every day. So, yes, I think our people are taking this quite seriously, and the county of Hawaii is certainly.
Because when the picture that's created of a landfill closing and needing to truck waste to the other side of the island, it certainly looks as if it's going to be a heightened cost to the county. Are there ways around to avoid that?
Well, we have worked this to and minimize the cost as much as possible. Number one, we would be reducing. We would not have the people operating on the landfill, so there's some reduction in cost there. Mm-hmm. They will be doing other activities, but we'll have about 8 trucks a day going from East Hawaii to West Hawaii to Pu'anahulu on the west side, and that's about 20 tons per truck. But that is about all we'll be trucking over. We're anticipating that 8 trucks a day.
Can you look past that to maybe getting to the point where there are fewer trucks a day, or is that number likely to increase?
Well, we don't expect it to increase unless we get a significant population increase, at which time we can take a look. But mm-hmm. we have reasonably steady landfill usage and waste disposal. What we're looking at are ways that we can reuse these materials, like organic waste. As we come into the composting, we're going to require food waste to enrich the mulch that we get from things. Palm fronds and the types of vegetation that we get is not particularly rich. It's still good, but the food waste, and we're looking at ways that we can increase food waste not going into landfill, and we feel that's about 50% of the material that goes into the landfill is organic waste.
So what you're describing is something that is, to some degree, predictable. That with the population, as you say, unless the population increases, you can get a pretty good handle on what's going to be a year, 2 years from now, is what it sounds like.
Yes, and again, we've been operating. I mean, the Hilo landfill that we're closing has been in operation since the early 60s, so that's over 50 years of operation, and we think we have about 1.5 million, a little bit more than that, 1.5 million tons of municipal solid waste that's been deposited there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, when you go over 50 years, that's a lot of waste.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just say our goal is to minimize what's going into the landfill and maximize what we can reuse, reprocess, repurpose. That's one of our primary goals and responsibilities in our department.
And one of the things I think you told my colleague Sherry Bracken that even once the landfill is closed, your responsibility doesn't end there, right?
Oh, yes. There's really two parts to when you say closing a landfill. One is you stop taking trash.
Right.
And you stop taking municipal solid waste. And that's going to happen in the next year or so. We're not sure because it depends on how much we get, how much we compress, a number of issues.
Sure.
It's not really an exact science because you're dealing with what you call airspace. You can go so high and it depends on how much you compact. But in any case, in about a year and a half, we will stop taking waste, and then we will start the closure process. And the closure process is defined very strictly by the US EPA and by Department of Health. And speaking of that, we have done an environmental assessment for the closure that was just published by the EOQC in Honolulu on the 23rd of October. And if anyone is interested in reviewing the EA and making comments, you can find the EA link to that on our webpage, which is HawaiiZeroWaste.org. And right in the events and announcements section, which is what pops up as soon as you click there, you can get a link to the EA. You can read that, and comments can be made and sent to us up until the 23rd of November. So,
well, Bill, we'll
just plug that.
Yeah, we'll see if we can send people your way. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, It's my pleasure.
Bill Kucharski is the director of the Hawaii County Department of Environmental Management, and you can find a link to the department's proposal to close the South Hilo Sanitary Landfill on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, the city of Honolulu uproots a semi-permanent homeless community. But first, your quiz. If you're a lover of poke and fresh fish, chances are you're a fan of Tamashiro Market. You can't miss the giant red crab hanging from the storefront in the heart of Kalihi. But Tamashiro's hasn't always called the corner of North King and Palama home. The original shop was started on an entirely different island. Chogan and Yoshiko Tamashiro packed up shop and moved the business for a very specific reason. For our backyard quiz today, we have two questions for you. First, can you tell us the original island location of Tamashiro's? And can you tell us the reason they made the move to Oahu? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and we'll reel you in later in the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
This past week's sweep of a homeless community under the Nimitz Highway Viaduct dramatized the extent of the homeless problem and the challenge the city and county of Honolulu continues to face. The viaduct was home to a semi-permanent settlement, some of whose residents has been there for years, all of whose residents were living in unsanitary and dangerous conditions. The State Department of Transportation is spending millions on the ongoing sweeps without knowing where the people being evicted are going to end up. HPR reporter Wayne Yoshioka has been following the story, and he's with us in our studio. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Yes, it was a multi-agency task force led by the State Department of Transportation. We had sheriff deputies there, the Humane Society, social service organizations, and they had a massive cleanup to do because they had abandoned property, illegal structures, and even some vehicles laid in there. And after more than a month of outreach, they still had over 100 people left, and Scott Morishige, the governor's homeless coordinator, will describe what was there.
So as of Monday, it was estimated there were 180 people. As of Friday, it was estimated there were less than 120. So we know that at least 60 people relocated from the area. We were able to get 5 people into shelter, 1 person into residential treatment. And then we're also working with animal rescue organizations to have 60 dogs rescued from the area and 24 cats.
Well, Wayne, where are these people going to go?
Well, they were just saying, we're going to go Eva, we're going to go Diamond Head. But according to the sheriff's deputies, they were going to sweep those areas too. So there's really not much choice for them as far as places to go. And the cleanup, I mean, it's such a massive endeavor that we have not only that, but we have also all these animals. And, you know, it's really a pretty dismal sight.
It's also a pretty expensive and labor-intensive process for all the government agencies involved, right?
Right. The legislature appropriated $2 million for this, mm-hmm. and the Hawaii Department of Transportation had matching funds of $2 million just to clean up the H-1 corridor. So it's going to take a lot of money, especially with this viaduct, and it's going to take until November 17th to complete. So that's a long time.
Isn't that just going to lead to another homeless community somewhere else?
Probably. And as far as the viaduct, though, they're going to try to fence it off, and the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation will use that area to store equipment. But as far as, you know, trying to find another place for the homeless, we've got the city and county of Honolulu talking about the safe zones for the homeless. They want to spend about $23 million for that. The Interagency Council on Homelessness, which is a state organization, right. they're talking about doing another safe zone. But, you know, we've tried all of these before, and some of the places, the public lands, the city and county properties, they're outside of urban Honolulu, and, you know, you can build it, but it's hardly, they won't come.
They're away from amenities, bus lines, even if you were to try to get back into society, get a job, how would you get to work?
Right.
That's what Sand Island, for example, is. You know, but it you know, Wayne, it really looks like a classic kicking the can down the road then. If you know, you're putting a lot of money into getting them out, but to where?
You're just pushing them around the island, as far as we're concerned. And a lot of taxpayers are saying, you know, why waste all this money moving these people around? Let's try to solve this problem. But as you know, there is no silver bullet in this homeless issue. It's a long-term problem that they need to start addressing from when people are young.
At some point, Wayne, you know, somebody's going to calculate the per-person cost of all this, and chances are it's going to come out to a pretty hefty per-person figure. And, you know, taxpayers, at some point, there's going to be some resentment kick in, don't you think?
Well, they're using the argument that all the emergency services that these homeless people are using in terms of the emergency rooms, in terms of the
police, ERs,
and all that stuff far outweigh the amount that they're spending. But they're spending $23 million to establish a safe zone. They spent $68 million last year just trying to do the revitalization of these other properties to make it into homeless transition centers. So this is a lot of money.
So has county, city, county of Honolulu gone into the safe zones? I understood they were holding back from the safe zones idea, at least for now.
Well, they're trying to wait, I guess, for the state to do it.
Yeah.
The Interagency Council on Homelessness, they've been examining this a lot. Two sessions ago, they tried to make a safe zone, but they just found out that the state lands and the infrastructure needs for those lands is just, you know, prohibitive. I mean, it would just cost too much to bring water and electricity there.
You know, Wayne, I keep hoping for a discussion of the homeless problem that doesn't end with the words, "What a mess."
What a mess. But when you have career politicians not solving the problem, I mean, who's going to solve it?
Yeah. Well, the next guy to occupy the office after you get out.
and term limits, all you have is an 8-year window.
Yeah.
And, you know, what can you do in 8 years?
Well, not much, evidently.
Apparently.
Thanks a lot, Wayne.
Thank you, Chris.
Wayne Yoshioka is Hawaii Public Radio's political reporter, and you can find audio and written versions of all his stories under the Politics tab on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Waldorf Fair, Honolulu Waldorf School's annual family fair. Children's activities, live music, and food Saturday, November 4th. Open to the public. HonoluluWaldorf.org.
The timeshare industry operates 95 resorts and more than 15,000 units in Hawaii and adds more than $5 billion annually to the economy. It creates tens of thousands of jobs and brings visitor spending. An average family of four spends $4,000 each time it comes here on vacation. Pacific News editor, Business News editor-in-chief A. Cam Napier is with us in the studio with details. I was surprised when I saw this report at how robust this segment of the economy is.
It's become enormous. I think people may not realize how important it's become to the visitor industry. In fact, basically all new construction that you see that you might think, oh, there's a new hotel. Mm-hmm. Most likely it's a timeshare project that you've seen gone up. The newest tower at Hilton Hawaiian Village, for example, is entirely a timeshare project.
Why is it more appealing to a hotel company to do timeshare rather than run a hotel in the traditional manner?
Right. Well, you know, developers of properties like these have been telling PBN that hotels just don't pencil out to be profitable. Now, that may sound strange. Hawaii is a beautiful place. Millions of people fly here.
But
the cost of building a property, the cost of marketing a hotel, the churn of the guests who are staying for a few days at a time, all of those costs add up. The developer of a timeshare is almost in a different market. They're selling fractional ownership. So they're basically selling one unit to multiple people, maybe up to 52 people. And it's just a different business model, so it makes things possible. Half of Aulani, for example, is timeshare.
And once the timeshare is bought, from the owner's point of view, it's bought. You've got their money.
Pretty much. You know, for folks who have the travel budget to think about these things, they're making a decision like a homeowner might, you know, do I rent or do I buy?
Mm-hmm.
And so the timeshare market appeals to people who think, well, I'm wasting my money if I stay in hotels and just rent short term. But if I buy a timeshare, I have some ownership, I can build some equity, I can sell this later if I want to. And, you know, the way things operate now in this marketplace, you have big organizations like Marriott or Disney where you're buying membership as well. And you don't have to just keep going back to the same city over and over. You can visit other timeshares. So you still have that flexibility and you have the ownership.
This would be something where you would want to be the target audience would be the comfortable middle class family that can afford to make a sizable investment and knows it's going to go on vacation once a year somewhere.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the numbers tell us that, one, they're more likely to come and stay in the unit. And for Hawaii, that can be quite a buffer. I was looking at some numbers, for example, that, you know, after 9/11, when there was a huge drop-off in visitation to Hawaii, no one wanted to travel anywhere. Timeshare vacancy was about 70%, or occupancy rather. Occupancy was 70% in the timeshare market in Hawaii. Occupancy was only 30% in hotels. So because people have paid up front in advance and a fair amount of money, they're very much interested in keeping their visit.
Yeah.
So they come and they stay. Other things that work well for both the market and for Hawaii is that they come in larger groups, they tend to stay longer, they tend to spend a little bit more. They are often repeat visitors, and so maybe they get a little more adventurous and start checking out things beyond the usual tourist activities or museums and such.
Maybe they'll dive a little deeper into
the local
economy.
Maybe dive a little deeper, get a little more engaged. And, you know, there are a tax source as well. In addition to the transient accommodation tax, a timeshare owner is paying property tax as well.
Which is something that most of us would never have occurred to us.
Right.
So it's a pretty robust contributor to the state's economy to the visitor industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet it's as you said at the beginning, it's kind of under the radar for most of us, isn't it?
I think so. You know, there are Hawaii residents who are timeshare owners themselves. But maybe if that's not how you travel, you don't really think about it. If you're not in the business, you might not be aware of this enormous transformation in the visitor industry.
Do you think it's a sort of a tectonic shift that's going to continue away from hotels toward timeshares? Do you think this is a indicative of a trend we can expect a year or two down the line?
Oh, certainly for a year or two down the line. I mean, companies like Marriott have been talking about, in Hawaii alone, a decade-long commitment to spending $1 billion, with a B, investing in properties here. You know, some of the biggest private capital improvement projects in the state have been the construction of new timeshares. So when people are gambling that kind of money, their expectation is this is the future of the industry for decades to come.
Well, that's certainly, if you're looking to prop up the local economy in a predictable manner, that certainly is more appealing.
It does seem to provide that stability.
Yeah. Thanks very much for filling us in on that.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You bet. A. Cam Napier is the editor-in-chief of Pacific Business News, and you can find a link to PBN reporter Katie Muir's story on timeshares on the podcast of today's show. A new name has surfaced in the Ke Aloha investigation, Allison Lee Wong. If that name is unfamiliar to you, you're not alone, because apparently no such person exists. Federal investigators say it's an alias that was used for years by Catherine Ke Aloha to commit crimes while she was an active member of the city prosecutor's office. The name appears on several documents that have surfaced in the ongoing investigation, as Civil Beat reporter Nick Gruby tells us in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
All right. This is kind of a fascinating new addition to the story, which really does seem to be unfolding on a daily basis, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, this all goes back to a 42-page indictment, which had a lot of different allegations in it about a lot of alleged wrongdoing. And one of the allegations was that Catherine Ke Aloha had used an alias, Allison Lee Wong, to pull off some of the alleged thefts, including one involving taking $150,000 from two minors who had just lost their father in a tragic medical accident.
Mm-hmm. But it also extended to the point where she signed documents as apparently purporting to be a notary, and notarizing documents, even writing a kind of recommendation to herself, yeah?
Well, that's right. So what we found is that Allison Lee Wong comes up in other contexts outside of the indictment. The first time I actually had written her name came about a year ago, or a little over a year ago, when Gerard Puana, the man who Catherine Ke Aloha and her husband, former police chief Louis Ke Aloha, had accused of stealing their mailbox, filed a lawsuit against them and said that they used Allison Lee Wong to sign a fake trust document, a fake and fraudulent trust document that was part of this reverse mortgage scheme, in which it's sort of complicated, so stick with me for a second.
Yeah.
A reverse mortgage scheme that was part of another alleged theft of money from Gerard Puana and his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the notary on that was Allison Lee Wong, according to that lawsuit, but there's no record of that notary existing. In fact, Catherine Ke Aloha's own attorney, Kevin Sumita, had asked the Attorney General's office for any sort of record of Allison Lee Wong, and they told him that they didn't have one. In addition, Allison Lee Wong appears to have written testimony in support of Catherine Ke Aloha and her nomination to become the director of the Hawaii Office of Environmental Quality Control. It was a bit odd stumbling across that the other day, especially.
Yeah. I have known Catherine for over 9 years, et cetera, yeah, from this fictitious person. Let me ask you something that kind of comes out of this story, Nick. If the allegations against Mrs. Ke Aloha continue to be, are proven to be true, what happens to cases that she has prosecuted as a city prosecutor? Wouldn't defense attorneys for past convictions be seeking to throw those cases out based on, her now potentially being convicted of some felonies here?
Right. I mean, this is a question that's been raised since the beginning of all of this, is how far does the alleged taint go mm-hmm. on other cases that Catherine K. Law has handled? And not just Catherine K. Law. Remember, there were at least five other police officers who were part of an elite covert yeah. surveillance unit that have been charged in this case, one of whom has already pleaded guilty. So, yeah, it raises a lot of questions. And there are defense attorneys out there, defense lawyers out there who are sort of going through some of those old cases right now to see if there's anything that should be challenged.
A potential feeding frenzy for the defense bar, I would think. Thanks very much for talking with us, Nick. This is a fascinating story of which there's more to be learned, isn't there?
I believe so. I think that there's a lot more to come. Thank you for having me.
You bet, Nick. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nick Gruby. Law school is an entirely new educational experience, no matter how you prepare, and for that reason, criteria for admission to law school are largely based on aptitude, not so much educational background. For generations, the law school admission test, or LSAT, has been the benchmark standard. But some law schools are expanding their admission requirements to include the Graduate Record Examinations, or GRE, in an effort to attract and retain a more diverse group of applicants. The University of Hawaii's William S. Richardson School of Law is one of them, and when we spoke to Loreto Coloma, acting admissions director, he explained why.
I think part of it comes to increasing access to the legal field, and in particular, increasing diversity to the types of disciplines that have access and can bring that expertise to the legal field. Particularly at Richardson, they would be able to bring in any background they have from their particular type of graduate program if they've already in one, or if they were planning to enter one, then they could do that as well. In many cases, there is no particular major that someone will take to go to law school. You just need to have a bachelor's degree. So really, it's open, and this further increases the opportunities they have, particularly when it comes to applying to law school.
Previously, and this is universal in law schools in America, the LSAT was the test you had to take.
Mm-hmm.
And it tests what?
It tests your critical thinking, your analytical reasoning, your logical reasoning, and it also provided a writing sample for the students to argue one of two points, both of which could be correct for that prompt.
Could you give me an example of a kind of an LSAT question that you might run into or a problem that may be confronted with?
Particularly with the logical reasoning section, they'll give you a set of rules, and the question will ask, so given these rules, can this occur? So say they've said X can only come before Q, but it also has to be the fourth in a series of letters. And so they'll give you the scenario, and you have to predict, is it possible, or which of these scenarios are possible? And so in that way, you're taking a set of rules and applying it to a situation in some ways that you might do that in law as well.
I'm getting this strong feeling that I never would have made a lawyer, but it does. The idea is to isolate your student body or restrict your student body to those who are really capable of the kind of thinking required.
Mm-hmm.
That's the rationale behind it. It's your perspective that the LSAT is not necessarily a predictor of those skills?
I believe that LSAT is a great predictor, at least for their first year grades. And it's a good predictor in terms of making sure that they have kind of honed those skills that they'll be using much more once they start law school. It's a whole new education experience that most students will encounter, different from what they've encountered in their undergraduate years. And so to be able to prove that you have what it takes, it's a really good predictor.
Well, why get rid of it then?
We're not necessarily getting rid of it, more so adding another I guess, way that students would be able to apply.
Mm-hmm.
If they've taken the LSAT previously, then when they apply, we will still see those scores. In this case, the GRE would be a supplement, and partly because of how frequently it's offered, then they'll be able to take that. And if they're performing at quite a high level already when it comes to their reading comprehension and being able to craft those arguments in some type of analytical writing, then it may be a good predictor. At least based on our internal study, it's shown that the GRE is, if not a better predictor of how students will do in law school.
What does the GRE test?
So the GRE has three main sections, a reading comprehension, and this other verbal section, as they call it, which might include sentence completion. It has a quantitative section, that's math, geometry, algebra, and then the final section would be your analytical writing section.
All of which are going to be useful skills to an attorney, right?
Correct.
You were saying that the LSAT is most likely to address the things that you would learn in first year law, is that right?
If you don't learn them, you're using them a lot. So if you've already kind of honed those skills with your undergraduate work, kind of using those in classes that you've taken that have those critical thinking aspects, that heavy writing aspect, then you can use those to help you continue to succeed in school, particularly in law school.
What would be the kind of things that an undergraduate who was intending to focus on law, to go on to law school, are there particular study areas that an undergraduate would be well advised to pursue?
You know, there's no particular major that we'd recommend anyone take. There's particular types of classes that we might recommend, in particular if it includes writing, because you'll do that a lot in law school, continuing to do critical thinking in certain classes, and building that analytical reasoning that you can. Then no matter the major, as long as you're able to hone those skills, they'll be definitely helpful for you to be successful in law school. And we've seen students come from many different majors, from the fine arts through STEM, through business, the sciences. So it's not a particular field that you might go into, but I can say we do see a lot of political science majors.
Mm-hmm. The question that that sample question you mentioned to me earlier as an LSAT sample question struck me as the kind of question, a testing of an aptitude that almost feels as if you've either got it or you don't. It would seem like the kind of aptitude it would be difficult to develop if you didn't have some hint of that already.
You know, anecdotally, I've heard that folks are able to kind of develop this skill, particularly when they're taking their LSAT prep courses. They're able to develop that skill of kind of taking rules, summarizing them, and being able to apply them quickly. And sometimes it comes down to a timing issue, and so being able to do that quickly is one of the strategies, as well as kind of all that practice that goes into it. So if you can do it in your undergraduate work, then it's well prepared. Otherwise, you can definitely learn it.
Loretto Coloma is the acting admissions director for the University of Hawaii's William S. Richardson School of Law. For today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about a popular seafood market that made the move to Honolulu from a neighboring island. We asked you to tell us which island it was and its reason for relocating. Chogan and Yoshiko Tamashiro opened the original Tamashiro's on May 1st, 1941. Unfortunately, that shop was not long for this world. The original location in the heart of Hilo Town was destroyed when a tsunami struck Hilo on April 1st, 1946. Fearing another devastating storm, the Tamashiros decided it would be best to pack up shop and head for Oahu. One year later, the family business reopened in Kalihi in the same storefront it occupies today. And for today's quiz, Rick Tolan got that answer right. Rick lives in Kihei, and he's our today's winner. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We admit it, we want to get closer to you. There's so much happening at HPR these days. Great new programs, unique local coverage from our award-winning news team, and all sorts of ways we can work together to make life in our islands even better. We'd like to tell you more about HPR and would love to add you to our email list. Please sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you, and with your email, you'll be hearing more from us soon.
Today's jazz singers explore a very different repertoire than their forebears a generation or two earlier, incorporating songs that were once dismissed as pop music fare. Jonathan Courant represents a new generation that has learned as much from the Beatles and James Taylor as it has from the jazz standards that have long been the jazz singer's bread and butter. Jonathan's performing in our Atherton Performance Space tomorrow evening. He's with us in our studio. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
What drew you toward this particular idiom as a singer?
Well, I think you can sink your teeth into it. So it was also just, I don't know if I chose it. I think it kind of chose me.
That's often the case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just took it and ran with it.
And in the course of doing that, picked material that, you know, came your way. You just picked your favorite songs that had come your way as a younger, you know, younger musician.
Yeah, well, I've dug deep, and I mean, I can do, I mean, I songs from, you know, Duke Ellington and even from some of the ones that Monk wrote. Mm-hmm. I love doing some of those that have lyrics to them that are a little more far out. But when coming to record an album, I kind of wanted to do things that hadn't been re-recorded, you know, 10,000 times by various artists, so...
Well, that's the trouble for a jazz singer of the younger generation is that, you know, How High the Moon and Stella by Starlight have kind of been done and done pretty well, right?
Yes, yeah.
It's tough to follow Sarah Vaughan or
Ella Fitzgerald or, yeah.
Exactly.
So she's celebrating her centennial year this year, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's how I picked it, really. And I wanted to pick things that I thought would perk people's interests and that I could kind of put my own spin on it.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a sample of a song you did that is an example of a jazz instrumental that's had lyrics put on. This is Horace Silver's Doodlin'.
I'm very busy doodlin' away. Do you doodle all day, set the waiter in his way? Do you doodle all night? I told the waiter he was right in your doodlin' away. That's the way I'm gonna stay. Are you painting things right? Doodling sheds a lot of light. I don't know what to do. Ain't nothing you can do. Doodling you, doodling's all I wanna do. That is for true. Why does every single thing I see look exactly...
That I believe that particular song started as an instrumental.
Yes, it did. And then later, John Hendricks.
That's a John Hendricks lyric.
Yeah.
You can sort of tell, can't you?
Yeah, you can tell. I was actually, it was like the day before my recording session for this album, and I heard that song, and I'd known it for years. I just hadn't thought about it in a while, and I said, oh, I got to throw that on there. That's too much fun not to.
Yeah.
It's got a fun story, and it's fun to sing. Singing night after night in clubs, that's one I never get sick of singing, and I almost can't finish a night without doing it. A lot of people request me to do that one.
It takes pretty serious vocal chops because it's, you know, you have to sort of move around with the kind of resilience of a saxophone, of an instrumentalist.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's part of the whole discipline of being a jazz singer. That's kind of what makes a jazz singer a different kind of singer, doesn't it?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Here's another song that actually I came to know this song as part of the blues repertoire as kind of a Ray Charles song. This is Please Send Me Someone to Love.
Please
send me someone to love. Show the world how to get along. Peace will enter when hate is gone. And if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love.
Yeah.
Pretty relevant song. And, you know, that's a song that was relevant when it was written in the 50s. And is kind of, you can apply it to just about any time, can't
totally,
you?
Yeah. I really like George Shearing's instrumental recording of it. And that's got that more like bluesy swing feel.
Yeah.
I thought that the lyric on it was such a positive message, so I put it at the end of the CD, mm-hmm. and rather than having the whole band on it, I thought to kind of leave the listener with almost a lullaby,
yeah.
and something positive to kind of think about at the end of the album, so that's why.
When you're accompanied by just guitar, does that give you a lot of more room, in a sense?
In a way, yeah. Not that I stretched it on that, because I wanted it to have a simple kind of lullaby kind of feel
yeah.
to it.
Well, it comes across with intimacy.
Yeah. When I play with a combo that's like a trio or something smaller, I do find I have to sing a lot more to
yeah.
fill the gaps. When you play with a big band or with a symphony, you really don't have to work too hard.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of other people striving yeah. to be heard at
right.
the same time, right?
Yeah. So, but I prefer like a 4 to 5 piece band.
Yeah. What are you going to have tomorrow?
Tomorrow there's just 3 of us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, piano, bass, and vocals.
What kind of material are you going to be performing?
Well, I'll be doing some things off this album.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got 2 new albums I'm working on that'll be released in 2018. And then tomorrow night I've also got some golden standards that everybody I think will recognize and love, some crowd pleasers. And then some newer things and some obscure things. So a mix of different things.
Yeah.
During a themed show, variety show thing I did in Vegas, I was asked to sing Miley Cyrus's Wrecking Ball. So somebody, I guess, called in or something and asked if I would sing that tomorrow night. So I didn't bring it with me, but I'm going to dig it up and probably do it. But it's, again, it's not anything like her version. It's a bossa nova and we swing the chorus.
It still is a bit of a stretch for a jazz singer, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Hey, thanks very much for your, I think we'll look forward to your concert, but thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure. I look forward to performing here tomorrow evening.
First time in Hawaii?
Yes, it is.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
I will.
Jazz vocalist Jonathan Courant will be playing a show tomorrow in HPR's Atherton studio. You can get details of the event and ticket information at hprtickets.org.
Went to make a phone call, didn't have a dime. I finally found the right place at the wrong time. There goes the bus.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-working.
A lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us at this point in the show for a look at events going on in our community under the radar. And today there's what have we got, Derek? We've got a Ridge to Reef Rendezvous. That's a new one on me.
Yeah, me too. That's happening tomorrow. This is the 8th year for that, though. It's at Kahikili Beach Park in Ka'anapali from 9 a.m. to noon. This free event begins with a catch-and-release keiki fishing tournament with great prizes. Check in at 8 a.m. for that. A tour of the haunted reef. Enjoy hands-on interactive displays, demonstrations, and giveaways. Once again, this is at Kahikili Beach Park or Old Airport Beach in Ka'anapali from 9 a.m. till noon.
Well, I guess in Hawaii, at Halloween season, even the reefs are haunted.
Yeah, everything
I
around
guess.
Here.
Yeah. Can't be too careful.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to learn all about the albatross tomorrow in Hilo.
A Mokupapapa Discovery Center hosts a free family day from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. Author and artist Karen Lobel Freed will give a reading and signing of her new children's book, A Perfect Day for an Albatross. Linda Elliott will discuss the albatross habitat, and the rest of the day will be filled with family activities. For all the details, this is happening once again at Mokupapapa Discovery Center in Hilo. For all the details on this, go to our website.
Any time to learn more about the albatross is most welcome because they're a pretty mysterious bird.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fun way of networking for professionals taking place tomorrow night in Honolulu.
It's a 70s disco and 80s retro Halloween party, and it takes place at the Arthur Murray Dance Center. That's something under the radar because I did not know.
Yeah.
There was one around. But
been
it's
around
on,
forever.
Yeah, they're on Kapi'olani Boulevard across from BMW of Honolulu. And this is from 5:30 to 9 p.m. for women only. From 9 to 11, men can join in. It's a meaningful way to meet people and learn about personal and professional growth. Registration is required, and you can find more information on our website about this.
70s disco and 80s retro. It just won't go away, will
no,
it?
No, no. I'm into it, though.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Okay, sure.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar, and you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Bain. You know that Sandy Tsukiyama knows her Brazilian music. On Saturday, November 4th, she shares with you an evening of well-known and lesser-known gems by Antonio Carlos Jobim. Purchase tickets to Just Jobim at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, a helicopter tour operator responds to community complaints, and a health policy expert looks at a public option for health care. Tell us what you think about anything you've heard on the program by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find out more information about today's topics and links to our daily podcast. And if you like any of the music you heard on the show, you can find today's playlist on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our production team includes Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday for more of The Conversation.